Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chew Manchu, and I'm joined by my amazing co-host, Sam Mazur. Say hi, bud.
Hey, everybody.
And our amazing producer, Rachel Holloway.
Hello.
All right. We are back with Dr. David Vitale. This is actually a part two episode. The first episode, we actually talked about acute pancreatitis. And this episode, we're talking about chronic pancreatitis. So if you're interested in acute pancreatitis, go back and listen to that one first. But hey, if you're here for chronic pancreatitis, keep on listening. So, David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. It's been a really fun time recording this, so I really appreciate you guys having me on.
Yeah. So, you know, for people who didn't actually listen to part one, do you mind giving us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll jump back into some cases?
Sure. So I'm David Vitale. I'm a pediatric endoscopist and pancreatologist at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. And I really enjoy taking care of these patients, especially now that we're going to get into the acute, recurrent, and chronic pancreatitis. These patients are special to me because many of them have, you know, had a really rough time with things, and there are some things we can do for them to really help them. I also have a beautiful wife who works at the hospital as well and does fundraising, and two sons who are 4 and 6. And I mentioned last time, it's like WWE at my house at all times. So lots of fun, and I'm looking forward to talk today.
Awesome. All right, Rachel, do you want to jump into some cases?
Let's do it. All right. So Danny Wersung is a 10-year-old boy who presents to Cashlock Children's with 3 days of increasingly severe abdominal pain and vomiting. He has had numerous hospitalizations in the past for similar symptoms, beginning at 1 year of age, and he has also been treated at home several times for his symptoms. He has an elevated amylase and lipase, otherwise labs are within normal limits. He is admitted to the hospital, treated with IV fluids and pain and nausea medications, and ultrasound shows pancreatic calcifications. He is discharged home after clinical improvement, and a few weeks later, he has an ERCP performed that shows pancreatic calcifications, intermittent ductal strictures, and diffuse pruning and irregularities of the side branch ductules. He is diagnosed with chronic pancreatitis. So my first question is, what the heck is chronic pancreatitis? And part B of that question is, what's the difference between chronic pancreatitis and acute recurrent pancreatitis?
Yeah, so great questions. So acute recurrent pancreatitis is at least 2 episodes of pancreatitis. And you have to have a complete resolution of pain and a pain-free interval about a month between clinical episodes. And that really classifies it then as a recurrent episode rather than one prolonged episode. You could also have a complete normalization of pancreatic enzymes. So say a patient comes in, they have an episode of pancreatitis, their lipase returns down to normal, and then a week and a half later, they come back with another episode. So if their lipase is normalized in between the episodes, then typically we could define that as a second episode of pancreatitis and put them in this acute recurrent pancreatitis box. The patients that have chronic pancreatitis typically would have to have abnormal imaging findings, some of which you described in the patient already. And those can include ductal irregularities, calcifications, pancreatic atrophy, which the way I describe that to patients and families is the pancreas is shrinking. And it's basically because scar tissue or fibrosis is replacing normal pancreatic cells. And that can be diagnosed by various imaging, whether we're talking about a CT, an MRI, an ERCP, or sometimes endoscopic ultrasound as well, which is a little different than transabdominal ultrasound. And in addition to the imaging findings, you have to have either abdominal pain consistent with pancreatic origin, evidence of exocrine pancreas insufficiency, or evidence of endocrine pancreas insufficiency. So that would be our diagnosis of chronic pancreatitis.
So we talked in our other episode, the acute pancreatitis episode, about causes for acute pancreatitis. In my mind, I can make sense of, you know, say a patient has gallstones and that's the reason for their pancreatitis, and then that could be a cause of acute recurrent. I don't know if that's actually the reality of the causes for acute recurrent pancreatitis, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts and reasons behind why acute recurrent pancreatitis occurs. And then on the flip side of that, like, what is the cause of chronic pancreatitis?
Sure. So really, when we're looking at acute recurrent pancreatitis and chronic pancreatitis, we really are looking at them in sort of one bucket as far as the etiologies. When we get a patient that has chronic pancreatitis changes, or even that just has a second episode of pancreatitis, we sort of change our tune. We really work those patients up with imaging. Typically, the recommendation would be to get an MRCP. I think we talked a little bit in detail in the last episode about what that really means, a magnetic resonance cholangiopancreatography. And we're really wanting to look at both the tissue of the pancreas with the MRR and also look at the ducts with the cholangiopancreatography and look at the bile duct, look at the pancreas duct, look at their junction, see if there are any abnormalities in the pancreas duct, see if there's some obstructive factor going on or some other sort of abnormality in the duct that might predispose a patient to getting multiple episodes of pancreatitis. The other thing that we would recommend typically is getting genetic testing. And when we look at our patients, pediatric patients with acute recurrent and chronic pancreatitis, at least 70 to 75% of those patients have some sort of genetic risk factor that predisposes them to getting pancreatitis. And some of them might have multiple genetic risk factors. Some of them might have a genetic risk factor and a ductal obstructive risk factor as well. And so these gene risk factors by themselves don't always cause pancreatitis, but we do know that in some patients they would be risk factors for developing acute recurrent or chronic pancreatitis.
Can you talk a little bit more about what types of genetic factors we're looking at, or specifically genetic diseases that they may have?
Yeah, so not necessarily. We typically look at, there's about, you know, when you look at some of the different gene testing, we actually do, our lab here runs one of the gene tests for pediatric pancreatitis. We're typically looking at 10 different genes with our pancreatic risk factor panel. There are a few other panels around that may run 12 or 14 genes, but really somewhere, you know, between 10 to 14 genes that we know may predispose you to getting a recurrent or chronic pancreatitis. They are not necessarily associated, actually most of them are not associated with other genetic disorders. Just to name a few of them, and one of them is quite well known and is associated sometimes with other a disorder, which is CFTR, cystic fibrosis regulator. And what we see is that a lot of patients that are heterozygous for some of the specific CFTR mutations, they don't necessarily have cystic fibrosis, right? But they might be predisposed to getting pancreatitis. Some of the other well-known pancreatic risk factor genes are PRSS1, a SPINK1 gene, CTRC, a CPA1 mutations, all of which we test for in these patients.
Now, we previously had a cystic fibrosis episode where, you know, sometimes we have patients who are diagnosed with cystic fibrosis late in life. Do you ever see the case where maybe a patient presents with a chronic pancreatitis as sort of their presentation for cystic fibrosis?
Sure, yeah, I sure do. And we've actually diagnosed, I worked very closely with our cystic fibrosis team here, and there's a fair number of patients, not a huge number, but a fair number of patients who have been referred to me for recurrent or chronic pancreatitis. We've done a sweat chloride test. That's actually one of the things any patient that we get that has a second episode of pancreatitis as part of their workup, we do a sweat chloride, and there have been a few patients where we discover they actually, you know, have cystic fibrosis. Again, not a ton, but it happens here and there.
And that kind of actually, you were sending the second episodes of acute pancreatitis. I was wondering, how many episodes do you get before you order the MRCP? It's like everyone gets one free episode of acute pancreatitis, but as soon as you hit the second, you get that MRCP?
You got it. Yep. You get, okay. You know, that's what I tell us. Like, you get one free episode of pancreatitis.
Yeah.
After you go to episode number two, you are in a totally different category. And when I counsel patients and families that come and see me after one episode, I say you're going to really hope that you are in the 70% of patients that don't go on to get recurrent or chronic pancreatitis, because that's a whole different category of how things go in the long term and what kind of workup we need to do and how things may progress.
And just kind of along those lines, the MRCP is really going to help, it sounds like, diagnose chronic pancreatitis because you're going to see ductal changes, et cetera. If you have acute recurrent pancreatitis where you return to normal, it sounds like you probably might not have changes. Does your workup change based on the MRCP? So is the MRCP first and then your subsequent testing, or are you sending all these panels in that second visit?
Yeah, so that second visit, we're going to get the gene testing no matter what. Okay. Because I want to know, do you have a gene mutation that's going to predispose you to getting pancreatitis over and over again? And then we're going to get that MRCP because I want to know, is there some sort of modifiable ductal risk factor or something else going on? And then it also helps us classify the pancreatitis. We have patients once in a while who come in and they're like, yeah, I had this, you know, episode of pain. And then, you know, I never really got my labs checked, but then my pediatrician did an ultrasound and they saw some things in my pancreas and we do an MRI and this patient has, you know, stones filling their pancreatic duct and all these sort of really chronic type of changes where we sort of classify these patients as showing up with more advanced chronic pancreatitis, but never really having that acute recurrent phase. And a lot of times, if you go back and you ask them, say, oh yeah, well, yeah, the last 5 years, every 3 months, I have really bad pain for 2 days and I never know why. And then I get better, you know, so they've had some episodes, not all of them, but that, you know, presentation, that second episode with getting the MRI helps us sort of classify where they are in the disease spectrum. And I tell patients all the time and families, I'm not as worried about where you are on the spectrum of recurrent pancreatitis to chronic pancreatitis. I mean, it's obviously important for us in our workup and what sort of things we screen for from a standpoint of exocrine or endocrine insufficiency. Really the biggest thing with these patients is who has debilitating chronic pain or debilitating type of symptoms that put them in a category of a lower quality of life because of their pancreatitis. And that can be patients anywhere in the spectrum of recurrent chronic to chronic pancreatitis.
So let's kind of just do the kind of your next step in clinic, and then we'll kind of get into a lot of our treatment modalities. So your next step in clinic sounds like, okay, let's say you get an MRCP, chronic pancreatitis is there. You've already ordered genetic testing. You said you're going to sweat them. What other kind of tests do you send on those patients now that you say you have chronic pancreatitis?
Yeah, so there'll be some things that I might send I look back on their workup for their acute pancreatitis episodes and make sure that, you know, we've had a good workup. We talked a little bit in the first episode about immunoglobulin floor, so looking for potentially a marker of autoimmune pancreatitis. Those are, sort of the main things that I'm going to look for from a lab perspective. I'm going to make sure that we have some imaging that sees the gallbladder well and make sure that we don't have gallstones or biliary sludge as a risk factor. And then I'm also going to ask about family history. I think that's really important. A lot of times in these patients that have genetic risk factors, you will find, oh, hey, they have a family member here or there that has chronic pancreatitis as well. And I also ask about pancreas cancer. So we know that in general, patients with chronic pancreatitis over the course of their lifetime, any patient with chronic pancreatitis has about a 5 times increased risk of pancreatic cancer. And so if they have some family history of pancreas cancer, I might say, oh, yeah, we've really, got to focus on this genetic testing and see what things look like.
Awesome. So in a patient who you can say, yes, I am convinced this patient has recurrent acute recurrent pancreatitis or chronic pancreatitis, what are the mainstays of treatment for these cases?
So it really depends in your workup what etiology you find, and also in your workup what you see on the imaging. So if we've got some sort of let's say medication that wasn't discovered after 1 or 2 episodes, take the medication away. Obviously, that's a pretty easy treatment. From a standpoint of obstructive type of issues, if we're talking about an abnormal pancreatic duct, an annular pancreas or pancreas divisum, there are different therapies that can be done. If we find, like in this patient that you presented, that they've got either a stricture in their pancreatic duct or stones built up in their pancreatic duct than an ERCP, where we go in and do a scope procedure and we get invasive and get into the pancreatic duct and try to pull stones out, try to balloon dilate strictures or put stents into strictures. That's really a step that needs to be done. And that's regardless of whether the patient has a genetic risk factor or not. We know that even the patients with genetic risk factors can sometimes respond well to endoscopic therapy if they have some of those complications. Not all the patients will respond. And when I do those type of procedures, I tell families, hey, you know, there's a reasonable chance you're going to respond to this. There's some chance that they don't. And we won't really know until we actually do the procedure. So for those scenarios where we need to do the procedure, we do it, and we kind of just have to see how they respond.
And then I'm assuming in things like cystic fibrosis or autoimmune conditions, you would have to treat the condition itself and see over time if their pancreatitis improves. In the cases of like a hereditary genetic defect, or really in any other case, do you ever consider pancreatectomy?
That's a great question. So pancreatectomy is, typically what we do, we actually have a center here that does this in a big team that helps take care of these patients with a chronic pancreatitis. We may offer a procedure that's called a total pancreatectomy with islet autotransplant. And in a nutshell, the pancreas gets taken out. It gets ground up in our islet lab here with our islet biologists, and they extract the islets from the pancreas and they get infused into the portal vein and take up residence in the liver. And the whole goal of the procedure is to relieve chronic debilitating pain from pancreatitis. So we have lots of patients that come in with chronic pain. They've stopped going to school and they're getting homeschooled because of their issues with pancreatitis. And sometimes these patients can be quite young, especially if there's a genetic cause. We've done this type of procedure in patients as young as 3 years old. And, you know, they can't go do their normal sports activities. They don't go hang out with friends. Some of them have mental, health repercussions of this. And when they start getting debilitated like that, the first step that we always offer is an endoscopic therapy. So just like we talked about that ERCP, some of those patients will respond really well and they start doing a lot better. Some of the patients do not. And they might have some pretty significant symptoms that are debilitating. And when they are debilitating, that's something that we offer where the pancreas gets taken out. It's a little more complicated than just taking it out and grinding it up, as you can imagine. There's some other aspects to the surgery that take place as well. But that's it in a nutshell. And the patients have to be willing to accept the lifelong risk of diabetes. Because, 30 to 40% of the patients do end up off insulin because those islets are doing their job. Probably about 50% of them end up on lower dose of insulin because their islets are mostly doing the job. And then there's some patients that still require high doses of insulin, like, a brittle diabetic might. And we also don't know, this surgery has not been done for, 50 or 60 years. When you're doing it in a 3 or 4 year old, how durable those islets are going to be in 50 years from now, I can't tell families that. And we're always straightforward and honest about that. We're really doing the procedure to relieve debilitating pain and poor quality of life from pancreatitis.
And pain is a great point because I actually really did want to talk about that. One of the main things that all these patients are coming in, abdominal pain, that's the main complaint that you would see. The reason why we're checking even to see if they have pancreatitis is because they're complaining of abdominal pain. Short of taking out their whole pancreas, grinding it up and putting the islet cells in the liver, and in between saying, stenting whatever you need to stent, what is your chronic pain management plan? Because I assume this pain is relatively chronic.
Right. Yeah. So there is a spectrum. So we might have one patient who has a pancreas that has stones throughout, is very atrophic, looks really, really bad on imaging. And that patient says, once in a while I might have a little belly pain, but really I'm fine. I still go to school. I still play soccer. I still do all the things, I still go out with my friends. And you might have another patient that has acute recurrent pancreatitis without many chronic changes in the pancreas. And they might have really debilitating bad pain. They're always in pain in between their episodes. Can't get up in the mornings, can't go to school, et cetera, et cetera. So that's really fascinating to me, and it shows me that we don't understand pain at all, and that, you know, there can be one patient with such an advanced finding on imaging doing very well versus another patient that's not and who's not doing well. So I think that's one point to put forward with pain.
Yeah.
When the patients come in with chronic pain, it really takes a village to kind of help take care of these patients. I mentioned, you know, sometimes there's mental health repercussions. We have a huge team of physicians and staff that help take care of these patients. And, you know, a lot of times almost all the time, we're involving psychology. We have a pain team, you know, pain physician that sees the patients, and they, you know, get, typically we start with non-opioid type of medications, and then move on to opioids if we need to. But really the mental health side of things and behavioral side of things can be really helpful as well.
Yeah, no, I imagine so. And it's awesome that you guys have a multidisciplinary clinic. So it sounds like that is kind of, you know, patient perspective or patient individualized and kind of have to move forward from there. You know, the pancreas does two different functions that I know of, you know, exocrine function and endocrine function. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about kind of the prognosis of those things as you move forward, and then we can kind of talk about treatment.
Sure. So, you know, there are a percentage of patients who develop, first in chronic pancreatitis, we typically are going to see exocrine insufficiency. So it doesn't take quite as much, the way I describe it to patients and families, to simplify it, as I said, it doesn't take a lot of your pancreas to be scarred down or gone for us to see exocrine insufficiency. And there are even patients that have exocrine insufficiency for other causes not related to chronic pancreatitis, but we'll focus on the pancreatitis side of things for this podcast. But that we really start testing right away when they get recurrent pancreatitis. We're typically checking a fecal elastase as a first line, which is an indirect measure, as you know, of pancreas enzymes. We do do direct pancreatic function testing, which is an endoscopic test where we give the patient a secretin to stimulate their pancreas, and then we sit right where it drains into the duodenum, and we collect all the enzymes and send them off to a lab and see how their pancreas is responding to secretin. So that typically will occur earlier in the disease process than later. And we're always asking patients also about symptoms. So, you know, are you having a steatorrhea? Are you having oil in your stools? I'm always looking at nutrition and weight gain. We're always looking at fat-soluble vitamins in these patients, other nutrition markers. So that's really the one that I get most concerned about early on. From a diabetes standpoint, we do see patients that develop diabetes from chronic pancreatitis. A lot of times that's a bit later in the disease course. But, you know, we've had our fair share of pediatric patients that do end up getting endocrine dysfunction because of chronic pancreatitis. That's where I think a lot of families end up with questions, and they say, oh, well, should I just go ahead and do a pancreatectomy now, or have my child get a pancreatectomy now so we can save some of the islets and, you know, save them from getting diabetes. And really, that's not the reason that we do a big surgery like that. It's really more focused on the pain side of things.
Awesome. And is there any interval with which you measure these things? You know, obviously, if they're not getting specifically better in that moment, you're worried that this is going to kind of get worse over time. Are you saying yearly we're going to do the fecal elastase and ADEK vitamins and A1C, or is it more every 3 months or just with symptoms? Kind of how do you manage this chronically as time goes on?
Yeah, great question. So I typically will see the patients every 6 months. And then depending on where their disease process is or when I first see them and how things are progressing, I will get those labs and do that every 6 to 12 months,
cool,
depending on how things have progressed. And I do typically try, depending, again, this is really patient dependent, and all these things here that I'm talking about, you know, they're not based on any sort of, evidence. But what I typically will do is get some sort of imaging modality about once every 12 to 18 months or so, where we're going to repeat an MRI. And I tell patients, you know, we're doing a pancreas checkup. I want to see, you know, is there worsening atrophy? Are there strictures that are developing? Are there stones that are developing that we could actually intervene for? And it depends on the patient's symptoms too, right? If it's a patient that's, hey, I'm even chronic pancreatitis patients, could end up in the hospital every 2-3 months with episodes. If it's that type of patient, we're doing this much more frequently, and we're probably, you know, thinking about going on the road towards pancreatectomy versus a patient that has chronic pancreatitis and comes and sees me once a year and says, hey, I have pain, you know, maybe about once every 6 months, and it's really mild and it's not so bad.
Awesome. Awesome. You know, I was wondering, just from a little bit of perspective from the exocrine insufficiency. So say we start to see some abnormalities, say steatorrhea, say our elastase, you know, vitamins are not being absorbed appropriately. Can you walk us through how to prescribe pancreatic enzymes? I just don't know how to do it. And I was wondering if you could help us.
Yeah, that's a great question. So we typically will start somewhere around 500 to 1,000 units of lipase per kilogram per meal. So that's my sort of typical starting point. You can go up higher. You know, the maximum amount we like to do, because this is per kilo dosing, is 10,000 units per kilo per day in our patients. And above that, we do worry about some, you know, issues with side effects from the medication, specifically having very bad constipation and in the cystic fibrosis population of patients, they can get a full obstruction from that. So we are cautious about going much above that. But typically, like I said, starting around 500 to 1,000 units per kilo per meal. I usually try to dose it at, and this is controversial in the literature as well, I try to have them dose it at the beginning of the meal. So right as they're about to put their first bite of food in, I want them to take the enzymes. In younger kids, we can have them open capsules, depending on the formulation that they have. They can open a capsule, put it on a spoonful of applesauce, and take it that way. They tend to tolerate that pretty well at a younger age. The other thing we are harp on is to make sure that they take it, even if the meal they're having doesn't have fat. So that's a question we get a lot too. Oh, well, this, you know, such and such has low fat, it doesn't really matter. No, this is actually, you know, helping with absorption of proteins and things as well. And then lastly, I do have them take it with snacks as well. So usually about a half of whatever their dose is with meals, we'll have them take that with snacks and any type of snack that they take. And then we can always go up depending on, you know, if we're worried more about weight gain or we're worried more about whether they have symptoms, you know, whatever we're sort of following for it. We can always make adjustments. Last thing to mention is that sometimes it's not as important with some of the coated enzymes now, but depending on the formulation of enzyme the patient's on, or if you're on a maximum dose, you can try to put them on a proton pump inhibitor, which in some studies has been shown to potentially help with absorption of the pancreatic enzyme supplements. Again, that's not through every study that's looked at it, but I do find that helpful in some patients where we're getting on higher doses and we're still not getting what we need.
And do you know if you're not on the appropriate amount of enzymes, is it hurt? Does it cause pain, you know, having that steatorrhea? So like, could we be treating some of the pain by improving our absorption, or are they kind of unrelated?
Yeah, great question too. So if we take a bunch of patients with exocrine insufficiency, and this is really anecdotal, I find a lot of my patients that don't have well-treated pancreas insufficiency will have a lot of bloating sensation. It's almost like irritable bowel syndrome type of symptoms, right? IBS kind of symptoms. So like, oh yeah, I get a lot of bloating, I get a lot of cramping, you know, and the way that I tell them that this is probably happening is they're having high, you know, fat throughput, you know, that are not absorbing things well. And they're having, you know, higher fat content going through the bowel, leading to some discomfort. When we look at all patients with chronic pancreatitis, regardless of whether they have exocrine insufficiency, because this question comes up too, if you treat everyone with pancreatic enzymes, there's really no good literature to say, oh, it helps with symptoms or chronic pain symptoms. So it's not a treatment for chronic pain with pancreatitis. What we do have is one retrospective study from the INSPIRE, this International Pancreatitis Pediatric Study Group, that looked at number of episodes of pancreatitis in patients with recurrent or chronic pancreatitis, and there's maybe a slight decrease in the patients that are on enzymes. So we're looking to potentially look at that in a more prospective way at some point as a group, but it hasn't really been well studied to date.
Awesome. And then one last question as we're wrapping up this episode, thinking about the role of the general pediatrician and managing acute recurrent pancreatitis and chronic pancreatitis, things like special nutritional needs, counseling on tobacco and alcohol use. If you could just speak a little bit about how we can partner with the gastroenterologists to really optimize care for these patients.
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think the biggest things are focus on, you know, making sure that the patients, when they have pain that's above their sort of baseline pain, that we're getting labs, we're making sure that in those times where we're worried about acute pancreatitis, they're getting the right kind of workup that they need. And if they're having debilitating type of pain, that they're presenting to the hospital. Because I can't tell you the number of times that we get patients who are recurrent or chronic pancreatitis, and they say, yeah, well, I've been at home for, you know, a week, and then, you know, having this pain, and I've been trying to tough it out. And then they show up with, you know, pancreatic necrosis or some other complication that we might have avoided if we had kind of caught things a little bit earlier. The other thing that sometimes comes up is patients will show up to us and say, yeah, and we see, you know, some minor sort of pancreatic changes, and we're not really sure if they've had a lot of episodes because they've never had labs checked. So I think that's one thing that's important when they're having that type of pain, really making sure we know if they have pancreatitis. I think from a chronic pancreatitis standpoint, just making sure that you're seeing them with some frequency, sort of checking in, making sure things are okay from a mental health standpoint is really, really important, because a lot of these patients have mental health repercussions. You know, there's really no, from a nutritional standpoint, there's no special kind of counseling you need to do. When we look at diets in these patients, we don't actually need to recommend low-fat diet, although traditionally and maybe sometimes in adults that's recommended. There's actually pretty good data out there on pediatric patients that that's not really necessary. We want them to continue to eat a normal diet and grow as much as they can. You know, one thing that also always comes up is tobacco and alcohol use. So I typically will counsel my patients to avoid tobacco entirely. I counsel the whole family to avoid tobacco. We don't want secondhand smoke exposure either. Alcohol use, you know, depending on the patient and what their etiology is and how frequently they're having pancreatitis, et cetera, I might say tell a college age student and say, hey, like, I know you're going to college. I don't want you having any sort of binge drinking, but you can have, you know, now that you're 22 or whatever, you can have one or, you know, two drinks in a social setting once a week or something like that. It's not going to be the, you know, the end of the world. But I do tell them, you know, none is better than even a little bit. But I want to be realistic too, and not sort of tell them that it's not possible. And then I think, you know, any patient with recurrent pancreatitis or chronic pancreatitis needs to be seeing a gastroenterologist, you know, with some regularity, just because, you know, I think some of this workup we talked about and some of the things and the nuances of following things since an outpatient are really important for them to have a person in gastroenterology to sort of touch base on with.
David, thank you again for spending time with us tonight. Now, one question, I think we're going to hit some rapid fire questions right here at the end. My question is, you know, I hear this a lot when I was a med student and things like that. I don't know if it's true, but, you know, with patients with, like, you know, chronic pancreatitis, where, you know, we're seeing sort of already this exocrine insufficiency, they have diabetes, like, when they, you know, burn out their pancreas, can you see, like, falsely low lipase or amylase when you're doing testing with them?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is a really individual thing for certain patients, where I actually see that sometimes where patients get labeled with chronic pancreatitis, and then you know, somewhere in the labs they get some amylase and lipase in an ER somewhere, and they say, well, this patient has pancreatitis because we know that they wouldn't mount an amylase and lipase response. And a lot of patients with chronic pancreatitis still can do that, even if their pancreas looks really bad. There's no way for us to know which patients can and cannot mount that response, except to know that, hey, last time they had certain pancreatitis, they did mount a response. I'm typically less concerned about those numbers in a patient with chronic pancreatitis and chronic pain than I am about imaging findings. So, you know, in those patients with a chronic pancreatitis, if there's clear imaging findings of acute on chronic pancreatitis, and typically we see those well with cross-sectional imaging, CT or MRI, that's when I really feel like, hey, I know there's pancreatitis here in those patients, and we need to treat it as such, as an acute on chronic pancreatitis episode.
And do you have any value in trending that lipase, like getting that when you are doing your usual workup? Or sorry, your usual, like, you know, 6 month to 12 month testing that we kind of talked about earlier?
Yeah, not at all. No. So we don't get that. We really only get it in the acute pain setting when you're trying to distinguish if they have an acute inflammatory process going on top of their chronic pancreatitis.
Perfect.
And then we mentioned a little bit about the like long-term outcomes of acute, recurrent, and chronic pancreatitis. And then earlier in the episode, you had mentioned something about pancreatic cancer, but I would imagine that's a question that you get pretty frequently from parents when you tell them that they're going to have these chronic sequelae of pancreatitis. What do you tell families when they ask about pancreatic cancer?
Yeah, great question. So it does come up quite frequently. You know, I did mention a little bit earlier, but any patient that has chronic pancreatitis, we know that, you know, in the literature, when we look at adults, they have a risk of pancreatic cancer that's about 5 times the general population. And when we talk about the risk with chronic pancreatitis, we're talking about specifically pancreatic adenocarcinoma. The thing that I tell families about that, though, is that if you take that 5 times increased risk, your child still has a higher risk of getting colon cancer in their lifetime, or lung cancer in their lifetime, or breast cancer in their lifetime. So although that's an increased risk as compared to the general population, the actual risk of pancreatic cancer is not higher than some of those other ones. And so, you know, we actually get that question from families too, when they might find out their child has a genetic predisposition to getting pancreatitis. They say, well, why don't we just do a pancreatectomy as a prophylactic measure against getting pancreatic cancer? And obviously we don't do that. You know, there, you know, really is no role for that, in pancreatitis.
Awesome. And then I imagine we don't actually have data on this, but if you talk about lead time bias, so if you're someone who's getting constantly getting scans, to follow your pancreatitis, you're probably going to catch pancreatic cancer with that MRCP way sooner than most people do when they come in with a obstructive lesion as, you know, a 65-year-old or something like that.
Go for it. We don't do any sort of screening in pediatric patients, because really when we're talking about this risk of cancer, we're talking about, you know, when they're much older in life, that, you know, that risk of adenocarcinoma is extraordinarily low in our pediatric population. You know, right now the best ways we have in adult patients is serial imaging to look for development of pancreatic cancer, whether that MRI or endoscopic ultrasound or some combination of the two, if there's a strong family history or, you know, chronic pancreatitis. I believe probably in the next 10 years, there's going to be a much better either serum or urine tests available. And there's actually a lot of great ongoing research with this in the adult world. So that'll change within the next 10 to 15 years.
Very cool. And then I do have one final question, probably for a rapid fire question here. Exocrine dysfunction, just to kind of complete the whole piece, as a gastroenterologist talking to you, you kind of walked us through how we should prescribe pancreatic lipase or, you know, pancreatic enzyme replacement therapy. Anything we're missing on exocrine dysfunction treatment?
Yeah, I think probably the one thing we did not mention is that I will typically put these patients on a fat-soluble vitamin. So, you know, there are various formulations of that available, but they typically, I have my patients take that once a day because they do need a little extra when they're not absorbing quite as much as they should be.
Awesome. Well, David, thank you again for completing this second part of your pancreatitis series. I learned a whole bunch about chronic pancreatitis. You know, I guess I just really didn't know much about it.
Same.
And I'm sure our listening audience really, really appreciated it too. So thank you again for spending all this time with us. Just thank you. So before we leave, take home points for chronic pancreatitis.
Sure. And quickly, I want to say a big thanks to you all too. This was really a lot of fun. You know, I really, really appreciate it. And I think it's obviously a topic near and dear to my heart. So I loved talking about it. And you guys had some really great questions. Fun to spend some time with you all. So I think the biggest take-home points for acute, recurrent, and chronic pancreatitis, I'd say second episode of pancreatitis, your workup needs to be pretty comprehensive. And at that point, really a referral to a gastroenterologist is warranted to be able to do that workup and get an MRCP and get a sweat test and make sure that the workup for causes of acute and acute recurrent pancreatitis are all completed. I think the biggest take home once the patient is really progressing to more episodes of pancreatitis, chronic pancreatitis, or if they have genetic risk factors, being at a place where there might be a multidisciplinary team to help take care of them is really, really helpful. You know, it's because as we've mentioned, this touches on a lot of a different sort of disease processes, you know, endocrinology, gastroenterology, genetics, pain, psychology, you know, surgery when needed, and also registered dietitians when we need to for different various reasons. So I think making sure that we understand that it's a tough disease process to deal with for patients and families, and getting them into a place that has a good support system is really important.
Awesome. Well, thank you again so much. It was fantastic. I can't even speak anymore. It's been so long. You've dumped so much information into my brain that I can't even speak anymore. So thank you again so much. We really have to have you back for some other episodes, because it was just so fun to talk to you. You had lots of pearls, lots of teaching points. It was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you all. Thank you all.
The number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids!
Get show notes and sign up for our weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. A special thanks to our producer, Rachel Holloway, and our wonderful social media team on Twitter and Instagram. I've been Sam Mazur.
I've been Rachel Holloway.
And this has been Chris the Chew Man Chew. Thank you, and good night.